Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump on Sunday mocked the hundreds of thousands of people who turned out the day before in cities across the country to protest his new administration. Mr. Trump issued a tweet saying, now in his words, why didn't these people vote and celebs hurt cause badly, end of quotation. 2 hours later, Mr. Trump said in another tweet, peaceful protests are a hallmark of our democracy. Even if I don't always agree, I recognize the rights of people to express their views. President Trump will reportedly spend part of his Sunday speaking with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu by telephone on several issues, including the Israeli-Palestinian situation. Prior to Sunday's conversation, a Palestinian official spoke about Trump's potential role and the decades-old stalemate.
The ball is in the court of Mr. Trump to explain whether he is supporting and backing Israel within 67 borders or supporting Israel as a rational state, abide with international legitimacy, or supporting Israel as a bully of the neighborhood.
Mr. Netanyahu's planned talk with Donald Trump comes on the same day Israel approved several hundred housing units in East Jerusalem settlements. Mr. Trump pledged strong support for Israel during his campaign and said he would recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital despite the city's contested status. This is VOA News. Syrian opposition and government delegates arrived Sunday in Astana, the capital of Kazakhstan, a day before peace talks, marking the first face-to-face meeting between the foes in a year. Russian media reported a trilateral meeting got underway late Sunday between representatives of the talks organizers, Russia, Iran, and Turkey. Russia and Iran backed the Syrian government forces under President Bashar al-Assad, while Turkey and the United States have supported rebels who want to see him removed from power. Negotiations Monday are expected to focus on cementing a nationwide ceasefire mediated by Russia, Iran, and Turkey in December that has largely held. Newly installed Gambian President Adama Barrow is expected to return to his homeland from Senegal after the former defeated rival left country. Former President Yahya Jammeh flew into exile Saturday night, ending 22 years of rule and a political stalemate that brought the nation to the brink of a regional military intervention. Jammeh did not speak or issue a statement before he and his family were flown to Equatorial Guinea. The United States released a statement welcoming the peaceful transition of power in Gambia and congratulating President Barrow on his inauguration. French voters go to the polls today for the first round of leftist primaries, but most expect the governing socialists to be ousted from power in presidential elections later this year that will center on issues like the economy, immigration, and terrorism. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
During 5 years of socialist rule, France weathered three major terrorist attacks, a struggling economy, and the migrant crisis, best seen in the now dismantled Calais jungle camp. Many French voters have criticized how the left handled these issues. President François Hollande has become so unpopular, he decided not to run for re-election. The seven who are on the primary ballot include former Prime Minister Manuel Valls and three other ex-ministers. They have sparred in debates over whether to take the party further left or further right. But polls indicate voters are looking elsewhere, to conservative candidate François Fillon, to maverick former economy minister Emmanuel Macron, and to far-right leader Marine Le Pen, who wants to close borders, end immigration, and hold a Frexit referendum on leaving the EU. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The 45th anniversary of the landmark U.S. court ruling Roe v. Wade will be marked Sunday with a new president, who has said he wants the decision overturned. Mr. Trump's position against abortion is supported by many Republican lawmakers, which control both houses of the Congress. I'm Michael Brown in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us in Peter Clotty in Washington.
Preparations are in high gears for Mr. Adama Barrow to leave Senegal for Banjul. President Yaya Jammeh left Banjul. He is presently in Equatorial Guinea.
Gambian President Adama Barrow prepares to return from Senegal to form his government.
This is not actually a new thing in Gambia, because it's one of those things in the police that we have seen in the past, that, you know, police officers must not marry foreigners. The details are not available to the public.
Zambian Inspector General of Police issues a directive banning police officers from marrying foreigners.
He says Egypt is waiting for new U.S. officials to be in place in order to come up with a common position to deal with chronic regional problems.
And rival Libyan leaders meet in Cairo with diplomats from neighboring countries to discuss forming a new government. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Gambian new president Adama Barrow is expected to soon return from Senegal, where he was sworn in at the Gambian embassy. This after he was declared winner of the December presidential election. Barrow's return comes after an agreement backed by regional bloc ECOWAS, the African Union, and other stakeholders with former President Yaya Jammeh. For the latest development in the Gambia, I reached Panderi Mbai, the founder and publisher of the Freedom newspaper, an independent Gambian online media network.
There is no definitive timeline set for President Barrow's departure from Senegal. All what we know is that preparations are in high gears for Mr. Adama Barrow to leave Senegal for Banjul. President Yaya Jammeh left Banjul. He is presently in Equatorial Guinea. Some of his guards, they are currently in Guinea-Conakry. Mr. Jammeh is away and the country is in a jubilant mood. Everyone is happy in the Gambia and outside the Gambia.
Some people are expressing concern that despite Mr. Jammeh leaving, there could be remnants of his supporters and security officers in there, and that could pose a security risk even for President Adama Barrow. What are you hearing from the ground?
The Chief of Defense Staff, Ousmane Baji, last night held a press conference. He told journalists that the army is willing and committed to pledge its allegiance and loyalty to President Barrow and his government. Mr. Baji said the army will continue to protect Mr. Barrow. He said if they were giving 100% protection to President Yaya Jammeh, they will accord Mr. Barrow 150% protection.
New President Adama Barrow has called on Gambians who were forced out of the country or run into exile, like yourself, to come back home and help rebuild the country. How are Gambians in the diaspora reacting to such news? And when do you expect them to begin going home? Are there fears that they will go home and face some stiff opposition despite the call of the new president? And when are you going home?
That's an interesting question, Peter. I will start with some of the Gambians who are overseas and they are not into any media journalism or any media practice. Already, some have started responding in large numbers. Some have started returning home in neighboring Senegal, where we have high influx of Gambian refugees. Arrangements have been made so that they can return home. Those who cannot afford transportation means there are groups, you know, volunteering, trying to help them to return to the Gambia safely. In regards to the bureaucrats or technocrats, some have started returning. The journalists have also started returning. As a journalist, I'm monitoring the situation. I will go to the Gambia one day. But for now, I will stay here and continue my job as a journalist.
How are Gambians reacting to the agreement the African Union, ECOWAS, and some other stakeholders signed with President Yahya Jammeh and the incoming government to ensure that assets and property of President Yahya Jammeh, his supporters, and some of his cabinet officials are not seized and that they are not intimidated or harassed by the incoming administration?
It is a mixed feelings, Peter. It is a mixed feelings. Gambians across the board, some are disappointed. They are of the view that this was a daylight robbery, given some of the atrocities, corruption perpetrated by Mr. Jammeh and his henchmen. For the United Nations, for the African Union and ECOWAS to come up with such a decision, some Gambians are saying that this was really, really outrageous. They're saying that the new government ought to have at least conducted what they call due diligence, investigate Mr. Jammeh to ascertain the veracity of some of the assets he acquired legally or illicitly. So, I mean, since last night, people are protesting. They've been calling, emailing the new government, asking them for clarification. They couldn't understand why Mr. Jammeh should be given such an immunity. They call it an immunity. For example, ECOWAS is saying that Mr. Jammeh's property should not be confiscated. Mr. Jammeh should be allowed to live in the Gambia as a private citizen, as also the head of the ruling party, the former ruling party. His rights should be respected, which we all agree, but to say that Jammeh's assets should be let alone, people should not investigate him, clearly people are saying that this is not fair. Now, from the transition, a member of the transition team, Mr. Maifati, he's saying that there was no deal reached. He said the purported document being circulated is not accurate, they are not aware of it. He's making a denial. He's completely denying that document. But on the other hand, the African Union ambassador clearly tweeted that indeed, I mean, such an agreement was made, you know. So there's a controversy here, Peter.
The UN is estimating that over 45,000 people left the Gambia last month anticipating a conflict or violence. How soon are you hearing that these Gambians will return home?
That's very correct. That's very true. The humanitarian crisis is just too much. There is an influx of Gambian refugees in the southern province of Casamance, in the northern part of Senegal. Some even fled to Guinea-Bissau. So efforts have been made to ensure that those refugees are relocated back to the Gambia. But it's going to take probably some couple of days before they will finally arrive in the Gambia.
Banderi Mbai is the founder and publisher of the Freedom Newspaper, an independent Gambian online media network. He spoke with me from Raleigh, North Carolina. The Zambian Inspector General of Police has issued a directive banning police officers from marrying foreigners. Kakoma Kanganja also issued a week's ultimatum to police officers who are already married to foreigners to declare their foreign spouses to his office. He warns that failure to follow his directive would lead to disciplinary action. But civil society groups have expressed concern about the directive, as critics say the order may be unconstitutional. To get a reaction, I reached Richard Molonga, an independent multimedia journalist in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
Yes, there's this circular that has actually hit the public domain, and it has become one of the trending matters on social media. You realize that this is not actually a new thing in Zambia, because it's one of those things in the police that we have seen in the past that, you know, police officers must not marry foreigners. The details are not there to the public, but it is understood to be a security detail, because you see, when you are a policeman or a policewoman, you hold so much information that maybe security secrets. And, you know, when you are in this marriage, you are prone to, you know, reveal some of the intimate security details about the country, you know, to someone who is a foreigner. And there are all these suspicions around foreigners nowadays in the event of terrorist attacks.
Some people are saying this is a xenophobic directive and that it also violates the fundamental rights of the men and women officers in the police, because the Zambia Constitution, they argue, guarantees freedom of association, which is key.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. But the security wings in Zambia, maybe even in other countries, are exceptional to that. Sometimes their human rights are waived. Sometimes their freedom of expression is waived. You know, in Zambia, for instance, here, the security wings, members of the security wings, have got no trade union. They do not negotiate, you know, their salaries. They do not negotiate their conditional service. So it is understood from that background that, you know, they put security before everything else. So it says that you are in the security force or you are out.
Richard, what necessitated this directive? Because it was said with much immediacy.
We do not know really the details why the exact emphasis, but with the advent of globalization, people are interacting beyond borders, and it has been observed that maybe some policemen and women are marrying foreigners, and this could be a weak point through which, you know, security details could fall in the wrong hands. But we do not understand why it has that red flag. We are yet to investigate and find out what is really going on, but it could be something that is bigger than what we are seeing.
I understand some civil society groups are particularly not happy about this. Has the Inspector General of Police, Kakoma, given reasons why he issued out this directive?
No, he has not said anything to the contrary. And in any case, the Inspector General of Police is not under any mandate to respond to any of these concerns that are arising from the civil society and other stakeholders. But it would be a public interest for him to, you know, to explain or maybe just give a word to the public about what is going on. Because even if people are police officers, they have a private life to themselves, and really just curtailing their freedom of interaction and freedom of association like that may not be unfair. But again, we have to also look at the security details. We have to also look at the security interests of the country. In Zambia, we have not had any case that we know of where someone in the defense forces has married a foreigner and this foreigner has compromised our security. We are yet to come up with that kind of detail, but really, as at now, it is quiet.
How are the citizens in Zambia reacting to this directive?
People are just excited about the whole thing because some people are actually not aware that this order has been standing in the defense forces for some time. It's just that we're in the advent of social media, so it is there for everyone to see, and people are just discussing in their pubs, in their homes, on the streets, and just laughing and discussing. It's not really something that people have taken seriously. They just gloss over it, and it ends there.
Do you foresee any civil society group testing this directive in court, perhaps, to challenge the Inspector General of Police's directive in court?
Perhaps, but I doubt. Because it's not the first time that such a thing has been discussed within the defense forces. But I mean, since there's a lot of advocacy going on around issues of human rights and other activities here, we may just see some organizations, you know, pressing upon the Inspector General of Police to also look at the human rights aspect over the security personnel.
Richard Mulonga is an independent Zambian multimedia journalist. He spoke with me from Lusaka. Rival Libyan leaders met Saturday in Cairo with diplomats from seven neighboring states to discuss forming a new government acceptable to all parties. Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry told journalists that further talks would take place in Algeria next week. For VOA, Edward Uranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Diplomatic talks between rival Libyan leaders and representatives of Egypt, Tunisia, Sudan, Algeria, Chad, Niger, and Mali ended Saturday with an agreement to hold further discussions next week in Algeria. Behind-the-scenes meetings between key players in the Libyan negotiations, including Army General Khalifa Haftar, also have been taking place. Haftar, who commands Libyan military forces in the eastern part of the country, is opposed by political figures close to the Muslim Brotherhood. Egyptian Foreign Minister Sama Shoukry, who coordinated the talks, stressed that Cairo was waiting for the new Trump administration to gain its bearings before discussing the Libya situation and other regional issues. He says Egypt is waiting for new U.S. officials to be in place in order to come up with a common position to deal with chronic regional problems, including Libya. Egypt and most of the six other regional states present at the gathering have been calling for the lifting of the UN arms embargo placed on the military under the command of General Haftar. Foreign Minister Shoukry argued that General Haftar's forces are the country's national army and that the UN embargo should be lifted so that it can carry out its duties. UN Special Envoy for Libya, Martin Kobler, told Arab media he thinks General Haftar should play a role in any solution to the Libyan conflict. Haftar, who is supported by the Libyan parliament in Tobruk, is opposed by a number of Islamist figures in the unity government of Fayez al-Sarraj. Libyan political analyst Abdul Wahab Laytan told Arab media he thinks rival Libyan leaders who attended the Cairo talks agreed on the need for a compromise. He says most Libyan leaders are eager to put an end to the current political impasse in the country, but they disagreed over the details of a compromise. Fayez al-Sarraj's government, which has had friction with other political factions in the capital, Tripoli, has yet to be officially approved by the parliament in Tobruk. UN envoy Kobler stressed that he hoped that 2017 would be the year of resolution for the Libyan conflict and not just a time for more talks. Algeria's representative to the talks indicated that most of Libya's neighbors would like to see greater stability in the country to put a stop to terrorism originating in Libya, as well as illegal migration. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The UN Children's Fund warns freezing cold temperatures across Europe are putting thousands of young refugee and migrant children at risk of illness and death. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund estimates 23,700 refugee and migrant children, including infants and newborns, are stranded in Greece and the Balkans. It says many of the children, who mainly come from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, are living in unheated shelters that cannot protect them from the winter cold. The International Organization for Migration reports several people already have died from hypothermia while making the treacherous Mediterranean Sea crossing into Europe. UNICEF spokeswoman Sarah Crowe tells VOA that people on land face other life-threatening illnesses,
like pneumonia, acute respiratory infections that are exacerbated in overcrowded conditions, and infants particularly do not have the kind of body fat, you know, that insulates them and therefore are more vulnerable. And pregnant women, of course, being sort of have a double vulnerability because it's their own health plus the health of their unborn child.
UNICEF is calling on Greek authorities to move refugees and migrants currently living in overcrowded and underserviced camps on the islands to more appropriate accommodations. Crowe says she is encouraged by recent efforts to bring people in from the cold and put them in heated hotels, hostels, and homes. She also says UNICEF winterization programs in Croatia, Serbia, Slovenia, and Macedonia are helping women and children stay warm. Nevertheless, she says many people on the Greek islands and in the Balkan states remain unprotected from the cold gripping Europe. She warns it is only a matter of time before there are serious outbreaks of illnesses if more is not done to speed assistance to those in need across Europe. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The World Food Programme in Uganda says it expects to feed more than 900,000 refugees this month as more people continue to flee South Sudan. But the UN agency warns its ability to support such a large number of refugees could be affected unless donors make good on pledges made towards supporting the refugees. For VOA, Simon Peter Apiku reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, estimates that if the current rate of South Sudanese refugees fleeing to Uganda continues, the number of refugees in the country could hit the 1 million mark in the next couple of months. Last year, the World Food Programme, or WFP, was forced to cut in half food rations for refugees living in the country for more than 1 year. Still, the WFP says it was providing food to some 870,000 refugees by the end of the year. Al-Khidir Daldum is the WFP's country director for Uganda.
The total projection for the month of January that we will be either 900,000 or exceed the 900,000 refugees. According to information from the UNHCR, that the total number of Southern Sudanese refugees in the country is 656,000. 417,000, those are the new arrivals from July 2016 to date.
Daldum says this number has failed to keep pace with donations for WFP's refugee operations. Daldum says they are already stretched thin.
We have a challenge of shortage in the pipeline. And as a result of that shortage of in the pipeline, we have revised our figures. And our figures now, the shortage from January to June is $57 million.
Daldum says it's not the donors are turning their backs on the refugee program. In fact, he says, donors have gone out of their way to assist the refugees.
No one, whether inside South Sudan or within Uganda, predicted that by July we will have that high influx of refugees to South Sudan. And as you know, we were already in the middle of the year where most of the pledges have been made by our donors towards a different commitment. So actually, the support we got from July 2016 to date, some of it was made outside the original plan that the donors have made for Uganda.
The UN Food Agency in Uganda procures much of its food directly from local growers. But official reports indicate that a prolonged dry spell in much of the country's food-producing areas decimated harvests, leaving more than a million Ugandans food insecure. Last year, Daldum says, the WFP procured over 110,000 metric tons of food items for refugees locally. Daldum says the drought may force WFP to import much more food at higher prices.
We are still waiting for the national assessment, and we are hoping that national assessment will complete during the course of the coming 2 weeks, and we will have the report.
Daldum says his agency's primary concern is working out how to help the thousands of refugees arriving into the country each week, and in partnership with the government of Uganda, helping those who have been in the country more than a year to become self-sufficient.
The challenge for us is how to meet the immediate needs of the arrival, but at the same time, for those who have been there for so many years or months, how we move them to the stabilization point, and then after that, how we take them to the livelihood interventions, those livelihood interventions which will lead to their empowerment, lead to their integration in Uganda.
The WFP says it's still too early to tell if it will have to make reductions on current levels of food assistance for refugees. But whatever happens, Daldum says, rations for those classified as being extremely vulnerable, such as the elderly, malnourished children and lactating mothers, will remain unchanged at 100%. For VOA News, I'm Simon Peter Apiku in Kampala.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports. For that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In the African Cup of Nations, Uganda lost 1-0 to Egypt, who scored in the 89th minute. The result left Uganda bottom of the group without a point or a goal after a previous 1-0 loss to Ghana, and their first appearance at the tournament since 1978 ends in disappointment. Uganda played well against Egypt, but they were undone by Abdallah El Said's late strike, which was set up by Mohamed Salah. Uganda will now only have pride to play in their last game against Mali on Wednesday. Egypt will take on already qualified Ghana in their final match on Wednesday, knowing a point will guarantee their place in the quarterfinals. On Sunday, Cameroon takes on Gabon, while Guinea-Bissau take on Burkina Faso. Defeat for host Gabon will eliminate them from the Africa Cup of Nations, but a win in their crunch game against Group A leaders Cameroon in Libreville will be enough to take them through to the quarterfinals. An early exit for the hosts threatens to put a dampener on a tournament which is already struggling to attract fans to the stadiums. And there are some fears that an early exit for the hosts could lead to unrest in Gabon. This is in addition to existing concerns the tournament could be disrupted by large political protests against President Ali Bongo, who was re-elected last year in a close and tense election. Gabon have drawn both their games so far with two goals by star man Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. Gabon go into the game weakened by the losses of both Juventus midfielder Mario Lamina and fullback Yohana Obiang to injuries. The Indomitable Lions need only to avoid defeat to qualify. In the other match Sunday, Burkina Faso will be without striker Jonathan Zongo, who has been ruled out of the tournament with a knee injury. Winger Jonathan Pitriopa is also out, but may return if Burkina Faso progress, while forward Banu Diawara is rated doubtful. Burkina Faso will guarantee their place in the quarterfinals with a win. In tennis, Andy Murray's hopes of winning a first Australian Open title ended with a shock defeat by world number 50, Miska Zverev of Germany in the fourth round. Murray, the world number one, dropped serve 8 times as Zverev won 7-5, 5-7, 6-2, 6-4 on Rod Laver Arena. It is the Briton's earliest defeat in Melbourne since 2009. And the lowest-ranked player he has lost to at a Grand Slam since the 2006 Australian Open. Zverev goes on to face Roger Federer or Kei Nishikori in the quarterfinals. Meanwhile, top seed and defending champion Angelique Kerber suffered a fourth-round exit from the Australian Open to world number 35 Coco Vandewege. German Kerber, 29, claimed Grand Slam titles at Melbourne and the US Open last year, but lost 6-2, 6-3. The American Vandewege, who is 25, faces the last eight meeting with Spain's French Open champion Garbiñe Muguruza, who beat Romanian Sorona 6-2, 6-3. Venus Williams also progressed, beating German's Mona Bathel. The 36-year-old seven-time Grand Slam champion, the oldest player in the women's singles, won 6-3, 7-5, and will take on Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova, who beat fellow Russian Svetlana Kuznetsova 6-3, 6-3. Finally, in athletics, Hellen Obiri defeated an Olympic champion for the second time this month in claiming victory at the Kenyan Defense Forces Cross-Country Championships in Thika on Friday. after beating Olympic 1500-meter champion Faith Kipyegon by a narrow margin at the start of the month, or Obili handed Olympic marathon champion Jemina Samgong a comprehensive defeat over 10 kilometers on the road to the IAAF World Cross Country Championships in Kampala on March 26th. Gladys Cherono, the 2014 World Half Marathon champion, continued her comeback from a serious back injury, claimed fifth in 34.02, with 2006 World Junior Cross Country champion Pauline Karikwanga coming in sixth with 34.13. By contrast, the men's contest was only decided in the closing stages, with Emmanuel Kipsang sprinting to a successful title defense ahead of Franklin Keitane. Both athletes shared the same time of 29.20, with Hilary Kering making up the podium in 29.47. Mark Pto, who turns 41 this year, was a competitive fifth in 29.51. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Take away your making me mad. Cause the way you pull it down, make me want to go mad. Oh my God, girl, the way you grind. Anytime I see you, I'm blind. The way you handle that. Uku. Dangerous. The way you do, girl, you are dangerous. Anytime I see you move it, girl, you are dangerous.
Like
that. Baby girl, you are dangerous.
Baby, palanga eka, and we love you forever.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Former President Barack Hussein Obama, the 44th President of the United States, and the man many Africans consider the compatriot, completed his service to the American people last Friday when, in a ceremony in Washington, D.C., he passed the baton to the incoming 46th President of the United States, Donald John Trump. It is highly remarkable that Obama, during his term of service, had no major scandal compared to previous administration. Despite unbelievable obstruction by his opponents in Congress, he achieved much. When he took over the reins of government in 2009, the American economy was in free fall. He managed to rescue the auto industry. He retrieved the loss of job every month in the thousands. And in the end, he was able to restore the American workforce and achieve phenomenal job growth. Of course, there are those who say that President Obama did not achieve much, but the records will show otherwise. He has been able to withdraw American combat troops from Iraq. He reduced American involvement in Afghanistan. He signed a nuclear agreement with Iran. He reversed a failed policy in Cuba. And he has been able to give confidence to the world community of American leadership. Yet there are those opponents of the president, critics, who tell you that the President Obama was very weak. And in this regard, they point to the fact that in Syria, he called for a red line which he did not obey. Now, these critics, who seem to have little capacity for analysis, forget certain crucial factors. Former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, who was in league with Obama to intervene in Syria, took the matter to the House of Commons in London, and Prime Minister Cameron asked Parliament to endorse his entry into Syria. In a robust debate, Parliament in London said no. And also surprising to Cameron was that members of his own cabinet voted against it. Cameron was able to consult with former President Obama. And after the consultations, he came back to Parliament and said Britain would never intervene in Syria. The next crucial factor, which has been ignored by the critics, is at the very same time, President Putin of Russia, in consultation with the president of Syria, came out with a plan to destroy all the chemical weapons in the arsenal of Syria. That, too, was accomplished. Weakness, indeed. But the progressive forces in the United States, in fact, see Obama as very aggressive, particularly when it comes to his drone warfare in Pakistan that resulted in the death of many civilians. Even some African scholars have been very critical of Obama's drone war. And one should not forget that Obama was also able to bring justice to Van Laden. When we look at the future, it is important to recognize that there are forces in Congress that are attempting to erase all of the achievements of President Obama. In fact, they want to have no sense of legacy for him. And they want to start with the so-called Obamacare. But they will fail. They will fail because the American people recognize the major achievement of President Obama. He is leaving office with an approval rating of 60%, a phenomenal achievement, compared to the incoming president, who is having the lowest entry, 37 to 38%. So I believe that Africans and all men and women of goodwill globally will recognize that President Obama has achieved great things for the people, not only of the United States, but for the global community. He has been able to establish a gold standard of prudent governance, devoid of boastful and grossly exaggerated assertions. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, parents give birth to the body of their children, but not always to their characters. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Among the most brutal and bloodthirsty members of the violent terror group Daesh, also known as ISIL, are a handful of men who communicate among themselves in English. This group of four, dubbed the Beatles for their heavy British accents, was put in charge of foreign-born hostages held by Daesh. These men are markedly more brutal to the prisoners than other guards, using extreme methods to torture the prisoners. To date, they have also executed by decapitation at least 24 prisoners. A number of these executions were videotaped and posted on the internet by Daesh. Alexander Aman Koti has been identified as one of the members of this group of British terrorists. Born in London, United Kingdom, in December 1983, Koti converted to Islam as a teen. Koti engaged in the group's executions and exceptionally cruel torture methods. Koti has also acted as an ISIL recruiter and is responsible for recruiting several British nationals to join the terrorist organization. The United States periodically identifies certain individuals that are of particular significance to a terrorist organization. In all cases, these are people who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. Alexander Aman Koti has been identified by the U.S. government as such an individual. As a result, the U.S. Department of State has placed his name on the Specially Designated Nationals list. His assets within U.S. reach have been frozen. No U.S. citizen or company may conduct business with Alexander Koti. This action notifies the international community that Alexander Aman Koti is actively engaged in terrorism. Designations of terrorist individuals and groups expose and isolate organizations and individuals and assist or complement the law enforcement actions of U.S. agencies as well as other governments.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.